Thank you, Sue. And welcome to the Court of Appeals. I am Judge Sleater presiding. Judges Cochran and Kirk join me for this third of five cases on our oral calendar today. This matter is file A210060, Brian Larry Lovis, petitioner and appellant Stacy Ann Lovis, now known as Stacy Ann Goddess, respondent. And so welcome, counsel, and to those that may be listening as well. Just a note that any separate recording is prohibited of these proceedings, but there will be a recording available on the Judicial Branch website within 24 hours of our hearing. And counsel, you should both be able to see the time clock, hopefully in the corner of your screen. And so each side will, of course, have the usual 15 minutes and then 5 minutes for rebuttal for appellant's counsel, if you wish. We do ask that you identify yourself for the record when you proceed as well. And so, counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Jill Frieders on behalf of the appellant, Brian Lovis. We brought this appeal and wish to raise three issues. The first is the court's failure to reopen the judgment and decree for excusable neglect. The court's sua sponte modification of rehabilitative spousal maintenance to permanent spousal maintenance, and the court's sua sponte award of conduct-based attorney's fees. I'll address the refusal to reopen the judgment and decree first. The facts in this case are very unusual. On advice of counsel, Mr. Lovis was instructed to go to her office rather than trial the morning of trial. His attorney, Ms. Richards, indicates that she thought that the trial time had been changed. She didn't realize that they were to report to court. Because of that, she and her client were 49 minutes, her client was 49 minutes late to court. She was 51 minutes late to court. When they arrived to court, the respondent was 19 minutes into her testimony. The court had declared Mr. Lovis to be in default and refused to allow him to participate in the proceedings, even though he was there. The court said that this held him in default and told him it was to teach a tough lesson, quote, tough lesson, end quote.
Ms. Frieders, yes. In your brief, you did reference that this was a harsh sanction, I think a couple of different times. Now, I didn't see in the record that the judge identified the method of proceeding by default as a sanction, but I take it your client believes indeed that was the basis upon which the court proceeded in default on that morning. Starting at 9:30, so it was already a half hour later, I believe, than the scheduled time. But
correct.
And so does your client, when you identified your issues, that the court improperly failed to vacate the default judgment, is your client conceding default judgment was proper?
No.
As a sanction?
No, we are not conceding that it's proper. I don't know how you can look at this at anything other than a sanction. He was late to court. She held him in default and wouldn't let him to participate in the proceedings. So no, it wasn't appropriate to hold him in default. There were many options that the court had short of defaulting him out. They waited a half an hour. So the court could have contacted his attorney to find out why she wasn't there. The court could have allowed Mr. Lovis to participate in the proceedings when he finally did show up. The court could have sanctioned his attorney, not him. The court had many options, much less severe than refusing to allow him to have a trial on the merits. And that's exactly what the court did in this case. She was teaching a tough lesson. And the basis for reopening a judgment and decree, it's 518.145, the Minnesota statutes. The family law statute mirrors Rule 60. And so excusable neglect, the standard that's in Rule 60 is consistent with how it's been interpreted in the family law statute. And it's clear that the courts do not punish or are not supposed to punish litigants for the errors of their attorneys. And the court is to has a liberal policy to reopen cases for excusable neglect. And
Ms. Frieder, is it correct the court found, and perhaps you disagree with this in the record, but the court did find that it was not solely based on the attorney's neglect, or in this case, the attorney's direction to come to my office versus to the courthouse, but the court made findings that your client was at the mediation the night before, had notice in multiple ways that court would start at 9 o'clock the next morning, unless there was a full signed written agreement, which would have to be presented, which obviously there wasn't in this scenario. So would it be?
Well, the courts on the record indicated that, well, there's the mediate. So her findings say that her staff informed her that they told the mediator to tell the parties to show up in court. So the court didn't tell the parties to show up in court the next morning. The court says her staff said that they told the mediator to tell the parties to show up in court the next morning. And Mr. Levis's attorney indicates that she did not get that message. She said that in affidavit. She said that on the record. And my client was following the advice of his attorney. And I can't imagine the chaos that would ensue if clients are to disregard what their lawyers tell them. Are we to have second opinions for when you're to show up in court? That's just a basic thing that a client reasonably should be able to rely on their attorney to tell them. So this matter had been scheduled for trial, I believe, kind of in a week of setting, which is what they do in Olmsted County. And instead of showing up for trial the first day, they went to mediation. So it's very plausible that my client did not understand that if he did not show up in court at 9 o'clock the next day, that he would be defaulted out, especially when his lawyer told him to not go to court, but to come to her office. And the fact that he had been actively involved in this matter shows that he took this case seriously and that he's not a litigant who ignored notices or failed to follow through with his obligations. He was in good faith following the advice of his attorney. And another concern that I have in this case is that the judge made all sorts of findings about, in the default, that it seems like the court was taking the position that they were just, that Ms. Pasternak, the wife's attorney, was just reading agreements into the record, but there were no agreements. The agreement, if there had been agreements, they would have had a signed agreement.
Ms. Frieders, just to clarify that, I don't see anything from the record, but you can correct me if I'm wrong, that there was what you described as a reading into the record. I do see that that respondent's counsel testified as to the issues, and I do believe the judge was told, and the record would support this, that the parties had been certainly informally, and if it reached an agreement on most, if not all, of the issues consistent with what she testified to. But is there any representation to the court that, in fact, this is our agreement?
I believe that Ms. Pasternak said that she thought there were agreements on many issues, and the court made findings that Ms. Pasternak read the agreements into the record. So there are findings made by the judge that there were agreements read into the record, but there were in fact no agreements read into the record. And when Ms. Richards at the end of testimony tried to clarify the record, Referee Baker would not allow her to say anything. She said she wouldn't allow her to discuss settlement. So that's a major inconsistency here. There were no agreements, thus scheduled for trial.
Can I just ask the follow-up? If there were no agreements, then what is the explanation that your client has for joining his lawyer at her office to finalize an agreement before presenting it to court?
Well, trying to finalize an agreement means that you are still working on the details of the agreement. And as you're aware, in a divorce case, there are a myriad of issues. And it's hard sometimes to settle one without resolving others. As an example, you can't settle child support until you know the number of overnights that they're going to be with respect to parenting time. You can't figure out child support till you know the amount of spousal maintenance. So that you can't, there are many things that one you can't resolve without the other. So they may still working on getting things resolved, but they had no settlement. If they had, they would have had a signed agreement. Ms. Pasternak on the record said she drafted a custody and parenting time agreement, but it had not yet been signed. So I draft agreements all the time because I draft proposed agreements. That doesn't mean that we have an agreement on something until it's signed. And Minnesota Statute 518.619, Subdivision 7 is very clear that agreements reached in mediation cannot be presented to the court unless both parties agree and their counsel agree. There's no indication that there was an agreement that anything could be presented to the court. The statute says an agreement reached by the parties as a result of mediation may not be presented to the court nor made enforceable unless the parties and their counsel consent to its presentation to the court. So,
Ms. Frieders, can I ask you a bit of a broad question?
Sure, certainly.
The court seemed to do a fairly detailed job of going through the Findon factors as yes. to each area, hence the partial granting Correct. Of the motion to vacate. And on those areas where the court did not, my question is this, since the court looks at the defense of the merits, and it seemed like that one and the prejudices are the two that court spent a fair amount of time on in terms of the factors. But as to the defense and the merits, it seems like the court took the approach that logically I might take too in looking at it afterwards is, was there some decisions that were made as a result of default that were so obviously one-sided that there must have, there would be a defense on the merits. And the court mm-hmm. meticulously went through those, whether it was the money regarding child support, the financial, the income and spousal maintenance, as well as the custody issues, which your client had agreed at the beginning were largely resolved.
Yes.
What from there would we find in the record that would be error such that yeah. we would say the court abused its broad discretion in denying the motion to vacate?
I think the biggest issue for my client is the claim to the house, the gift letters from his parents, and his non-marital claim of approximately $100,000 to the home.
Was that issue raised before the district court?
It was raised, the court even acknowledged that it was listed in the exhibit list, but listed as a debt to his parents rather than listed as a non-marital claim. Carol Pasternak told the court that debts to his parents were an issue. And the court in its decision dealt with the issue by saying that that he was responsible for the debt to his parents, but the court didn't say what the amount of the debt was, and it wasn't considered part of the value of that debt was not considered in the property division. So the court did not address the gift letters, nor did it address it didn't address the gift letters because he wasn't allowed to present that evidence. And even though the court was aware there was a debt to his parents, the court does not set forth the amount of the debt, nor does the court consider that debt in an equitable division of the marital estate. So I think that's a significant issue and a very important issue to my client. I want to, before I run out of time, deal with the court's sua sponte modification of spousal maintenance. If you haven't done a lot of family law in your life, this might not be intuitive. There are two types of temporary maintenance in family law. Before the divorce, the court can issue an interim order under Minnesota Statute 518.131, and that's called temporary maintenance. Then once the case is finalized, the court can issue one of two types of spousal maintenance. It can issue temporary maintenance, which is also called rehabilitative maintenance, or it can issue permanent maintenance. In this case, at Ms. Gaddis's request, the court awarded temporary slash rehabilitative maintenance as its final decision. During the pandemic, the court on an interim basis suspended spousal maintenance because both parties had changes in their incomes. And then when the court sua sponte reinstated the maintenance order, the final maintenance order under the maintenance statute, the court transformed it from a temporary rehabilitative award to a permanent award. That is significant. It was supposed to end. Ms. Gaddis asked in her default hearing for it to end on June 30th, 2022. It now doesn't, it never ends.
But counsel, it isn't characterized as permanent maintenance, is it?
It says it shall, it continues until further order of the court. And under the Gales case, a case that when spousal maintenance has no end date, it's considered permanent maintenance. So I don't know if this is a clerical error on the judge's part or it was intentional. I wrote to the court asking for reconsideration. My letter went ignored. And given the procedural posture of this case, going back for another motion for amended findings seemed not helpful. But in any event, the court's award is now a permanent award. It changes the burden of proof for modification from Ms. Gaddis to my client, and there is no end date. And that is significant to my client, and I think is a basis for reversal. My time is up.
Very well, thank you, Ms. Frieders, and you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And counsel for respondent, would you please identify yourself for our record, and then you may begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Kate Bjorklund, and I represent the respondent in this matter. This case is about whether the district court abused its discretion when it denied appellant's motion to vacate the default judgment against him. The district court did not abuse its discretion. Appellant was entitled to relief only if he affirmatively proved all four factors under Findon. He failed to do so, despite multiple opportunities. Importantly,
Ms. Bjorklund, I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you just a moment before you get to that. You had a footnote regarding the issue of default itself, the court proceeding in default. My first question is to you, do you believe the issue of whether it was proper for the court to impose default as a sanction is properly before us? And secondly, assuming it is, did the court make findings as to why it was proceeding in default, or how do we review it? I didn't see any such findings. The court just proceeded because appellant was late, as I know, but I'm assuming it was as a sanction, though the court didn't say that. What do we make of that record, and how do we review it?
Your Honor, in order to reopen the default judgment, the question is not simply whether the district court erred in entering default. That's what the Findon factors are for. So in order for the district court to reopen the default judgment, not only does appellant have to prove that he has a reasonable excuse for his tardiness or for coming to court late, he also must prove that he has a reasonable defense on the merits, as well as two other factors. And then this court reviews the district court's decision.
Wouldn't it be true, though, Ms. Bjorklund, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but just to clarify that if we found the court abused its discretion in proceeding by default, we would not need to get to the motion to vacate. We would simply reverse and remand for trial.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree. In order, the question before the court today is whether the district court abused its discretion when it denied appellant's motion to vacate, not whether the district court rightfully entered a default judgment. As opposing counsel mentioned, the order, what a court does when a default judgment is entered, in order to reopen it, it needs to follow the Findon factors. And that's uncontested in this case, that issue of law. And in order for the judgment to be reopened, the petitioner must meet all four factors, affirmatively prove those. It is the petitioner's burden. And then this court today is answering whether the district court, in reviewing those Findon factors, for each of the issues on the motion to default abused its discretion in finding that for the issues that we're currently talking about, petitioner failed to meet the four Findon factors. So it's sort of like a Russian nesting doll in terms of what the court is reviewing today. It's not the initial default judgment. It's whether the district court abused its discretion in declining to reopen the judgment as applied to the issues on appeal today. And as Your Honor mentioned, the court did reopen certain issues in the default judgment because it found that petitioner established his burden of proof regarding the Findon factors. And regarding whether the district court erred in the first place in entering a default judgment, we don't take a position on that today because we don't need to, because such a finding would be necessary but insufficient. And importantly, the Findon factors are more than procedural or technical requirements. These factors balance issues of fairness to all litigants, as well as efficiency for the courts. They ensure that a party does not get to reopen litigation based on arguments that it had no merit to begin with, or based on disputes that the moving party did not bring earlier in litigation, such as in pretrial submissions or in pleadings. Appellant's focus on the case, as previously described, that he had a reasonable excuse for his tardiness, such that the district court should not have entered default in the first instance, ignores the balance in Minnesota law under the Findon factors. Proving a reasonable excuse is necessary but insufficient for the relief that appellant seeks. An appellant is not entitled. Yes.
You know, I was a trial court judge for 23 years. I would have never in a million years considered default judgment under these facts. Isn't there something wrong here?
Your Honor.
And I guess if I was representing the other side, I would remind the court that one of the goals of family court is to see if parties can come to an agreement so that they don't keep coming back to court and have all these expenses and stuff. Why not just send them out that morning and say, can you finalize your agreement and bring it back in? I just don't understand why it happened this way. It just seems so contrary to all the policies in the way we do things.
Your Honor, appellant has had numerous opportunities to be heard. And importantly, one of those included the pretrial submission to the court regarding the statement of the issues. And this brings me to an important point regarding whether a binding agreement is necessary. Appellant's argument regarding a stipulated agreement or some kind of binding written agreement is a red herring. The district court mentioned—
Wait, counsel. How is that a red herring? I did a lot of family law where there was mediation and then an agreement on the record. But the agreement on the record was their signed stipulation. And it wasn't an agreement until that was presented to the court and approved by the court. I just don't understand where you're going.
So it's a red herring because the issue before the court today is not whether the courts had a binding agreement or whether they came to a specific mediated official agreement. The question is whether appellant had a reasonable defense on the merits as to the issue of parenting time, as well as other different issues. And this, you don't need a binding agreement in order to say that appellant simply doesn't have an argument. The function of saying that the parties came to an agreement essentially says that this was undisputed. This was uncontested. The parties agreed that respondent and the children would be moving to Morris, Minnesota. And you don't need a binding agreement in order to show that this really wasn't before the court anymore. The purpose of
Ms. Bjorklund, I'm going to interrupt. I'm sorry. I'm following a little bit Judge Kirk's comment, and that's probably why I started the way I did. It seems to me that if a court abuses its discretion in proceeding by default in the first instance, then we don't get to issues as to whether he had a defense on the merit. In other words, the Findon factors. I'm going to pose a bit of a hypothetical. What is the status of the case if instead of waiting till 9:30, your client had agreed, let's wait till 10. Now we're all present. What do you believe by this record would have happened next? Would have been closer to what Judge Kirk is referring to, because it certainly sounds from the record, everybody was within literally inches of an agreement. Or do you believe it then they would have proceeded in a contested trial? And if that's the case, is 19 minutes a proper time period by which a court decides to impose a sanction something other than one of those two options?
Your Honor, I'm not entirely sure how the case would have proceeded procedurally, but what I can say is that part of what the Findon factors measure is whether the ultimate effect would be different. And based on the fulsome record that we have regarding the parties' relative financial situations, as well as what the parties had functionally agreed to or what was being actively disputed, I think the orders would be tremendously similar. And part of the reason that the standard of review is important here is what the Findon factors essentially help the court decide whether the district court abused its discretion in denying the motion to vacate. Because what it partly measures is there any meaningful chance that things would have gone differently? And the answer here, I believe, is no.
Just to clarify that comment, Ms. Bjorklund, is there anything in the record that would suggest we could look at that and make that statement in our order?
Yes. And I think one strong example of that would be regarding spousal maintenance and child support. So appellant asserts that the district court should have imputed respondent's potential earnings as her income without providing any other argument suggesting that somehow this was incorrect. And this is confusing because that's exactly what the district court did. At the hearing, respondent testified that she believed her potential earnings could be $30,000 a year. The district court agreed and imputed her that income, and that's what all of the financial issues were based off of. To date, in the motion to vacate and any of the subsequent motions involving the party's financial situations and before this court, appellant has offered no evidence suggesting that she could be earning something different, that somehow $30,000 was wrong, or that it should be doing something else. The district court did exactly what appellant asks before this court now. And that's one strong example that reopening this judgment, this default judgment, will make no functional difference to what has gone on and will instead prolong litigation and give an appellant who's had multiple bites at the apple at this point. If you look through the record, the number of proceedings before the district court is substantial for no meaningful purpose. And that's an issue of fairness and equity as well.
Ms. Bjorklund, I want to turn your attention a bit to the spousal maintenance issue. The case law you cited in your brief, in the mayor's case in particular, all the cases related to that, there's a reservation. There's some language in a court order which would keep the issue of spousal maintenance open. I did not see any such language here. And so, for lack of a better phrase, it looked to me like the court made a final decision of a temporary or rehabilitative spousal maintenance. And so you have the first order that says the deadline of, I think, end July of 2022, perhaps June 30th, something like that. And then you have the suspension or vacate terminating, the suspending of it during COVID. And then all of a sudden we have an order, it's $1,000 until further order of the court. And I assume you concede, I think from the brief, there was no motion to modify. There was no issue before the court. The court simply on its own changed from temporary to permanent. Would that be a fair characterization?
Correct, yes.
And what basis authority would a court have to do that? I'll throw you the hypothetical. Let's assume we didn't have acrimonious parties like we have here and 5 years, let's do a little better. Before May of 2022, the court issues an order making it permanent. Would that be proper?
Yes, because functionally, we don't contest that the spousal maintenance order functionally went from temporary to permanent in the sense that it is now indefinite. But it was permissible to do so, and it was permissible to do sua sponte, because this isn't the kind of instance where the district court came to a conclusion out of the blue without fulsome evidence of the party's financial situations as well as the party's positions on the other's financial situation. Walensky was a relatively similar case where it involved the referee who was very familiar with the party's financial situations and on that basis decided to reinstate a prior award. And that's functionally what the court did here. And even if this court decides that the court erred in its sua sponte order, it was likely harmless error, given that the respondent, based on their financial situations, it's reasonable that she could have sought an extension and the court would have more than enough evidence to grant that given the party's earning potential and earning power. And if it's all right, I want to make sure that I respond to
when you say harmless error, you're bringing really what's a criminal concept into a family court proceeding. How is the error harmless to the husband in this case?
So it's simply another way of stating that there is more than enough evidence and evidence of the party's positions for the court to do what it did. And just like all the other issues in this case that we're discussing here today, there's no meaningful chance that things would have come out differently were the default judgment to be reopened. And what
I
would
like to believe that, counsel? You believe that if there had been a fulsome hearing where both parties presented their positions on whether this should be temporary or permanent maintenance, that it would have come out permanent for sure?
Well, appellant has retained his ability to seek modifications of the award like he has already done. And notably, it's important that appellant misquoted.
Yeah, but you've got to have a change in circumstances. What are the change in circumstances that are going to let him come back into court and do that?
Well, he already brought one. His income was decreased during COVID. The court agreed, and it suspended decreased the spousal maintenance for the time. If something like that ever happens again, he can do that again. I also want to make sure that I get to.
Boy, that's not due process, counsel.
Regarding the exhibit list following the motion to vacate, Judge, you had asked whether he had raised the issue before pretrial, and he did not. He raised the issue of the $100,000 credit in the motion to vacate after the default judgment. Thank you. If the court has no further questions, respondent respectfully asks that you affirm.
Was the $100,000 issue discussed in mediation?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor.
Your Honor, I don't think either counsel were trial court counsel, so we don't know for sure, but my client indicates that it was. And it was discussed because Carol Pasternak told Referee Baker on the record that it was an issue, and Referee Baker I don't believe there are any findings on the debt to his parents, but Referee Baker did order my client to pay the debt to his parents. So the court was aware of it.
I'm going to ask the marshal. There we go. I have Judge Cochran back. I just wanted to, before we continued, very well. I just want to clarify before we turn to your rebuttal, if Judge Kirk had a follow-up question for counsel for a respondent.
No, not at this point.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And Ms. Frieders, you may now begin your rebuttal.
I apologize for jumping in like that. I forgot that we were at the Court of Appeals rather than a trial court. Opposing counsel has indicated that my client, that there's no error or no harm to my client changing spousal maintenance from rehabilitative / temporary to permanent. There most certainly is. It changes the amount of time he has to pay spousal maintenance, and it changes the burden of proof in modification of spousal maintenance. So it is significant. Ms. Gaddis has a duty to rehabilitate under the old order. She no longer has a duty to rehabilitate. It really changes the standard in the playing field for my client dramatically. She indicates that my client hasn't provided evidence to support his positions on various issues. He wasn't allowed to. He wasn't allowed to participate in the trial. So there was no forum for him to provide the evidence necessary to support his positions. And yes, there's been a number of hearings in this matter. When I say a number of hearings, that's not true. There was the issue of modification of spousal maintenance and forcing the sale of the home was heard on affidavits only. There was no hearing. And later there was an evidentiary hearing on the HELOC debt and personal property. And that was very frustrating to me because we're going through the motions of having an evidentiary hearing on relatively insignificant issues and completely ignoring the big issues that were important in this case.
Ms. Frieders, can I interrupt you a moment? I wanted to ask you a question about what happened when your client's trial counsel walked in a couple minutes after your client. In looking at the transcript, it looks to me like there was very little opportunity, if any, for trial counsel to explain the mishap, the misapprehension, the misunderstanding as to why your client was not present. Instead, it was some comments were made towards the very end, but I didn't see anything in the transcript of any explanation, literally, of why the two of them were late. And that it related, if I understand now, and affidavits are submitted for the motion to vacate to finalize an agreement. So am I right on those two parts that we now have a record that shows that indeed they were late because trial counsel told the client to come to the office, let's finalize agreement. But that during the, when they walked in the court, referee did not allow for an explanation and simply continued until the default hearing was concluded. Yes. Am I accurate in that?
My recollection that the transcript, when they walked into the courtroom, referee Baker told them to sit quietly in the back of the courtroom and listen carefully. And then when Ms. Richards tried to raise some issues, she was shut down, told we aren't going to discuss settlement, something along those lines. Yes. So even though they were in the courtroom, they were not allowed to participate in the trial.
Thank you.
This is a frustrating case where my client feels as if he was completely unheard and taken it, he doesn't understand why this happened to him. He doesn't understand why he wasn't allowed to have his day in court. And he doesn't understand why his wife was able to get everything she wanted. And he wasn't able to participate in the proceedings. It's a sanction against him that is completely unfair under the circumstances. And he had every right to rely on his attorney's advice with respect to what to do the morning of trial. I can't imagine a world where my clients have to, especially in Olmsted County where trials are scheduled week of, have to get a second opinion as to when they're supposed to show up in court. We respectfully request that the court reopen the judgment and decree, or at the very least, reverse the issue of spousal maintenance and turning it into permanent maintenance. And we didn't talk about attorney's fees, but I don't think that my client should be given bad faith attorney's fees in this situation. It's just a the errors that happened in this case are of no fault of his own. Thank you.
And thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions today and your briefing in this matter. We will now take the matter under advisement and issue a ruling within the statutory time period. This matter is now adjourned. You each have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. We